Well, hi everybody, my name's Sandy Beach and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sandy.
I want to thank everybody for coming back. And if you haven't been here before, what we're doing is talking about AA, trying to tell some stories about its history and share some thoughts from somebody who's been around a long time about what maybe this spirituality looks like from this end of the swamp. And if it's helpful, that's wonderful. If not, then don't buy the CDs. And Chris will remain a pauper. And as I said earlier, this is not a step class or a lecture or a workshop. It's just some ideas about everything. And the person to listen to about anything in your early sobriety is your sponsor. So if something here seems different than what he or she told you, then you just go along with your sponsor. Because that relationship is incredibly powerful. And that's where you want to have faith, and you want to just do the suggestions that come from there and see if you don't get wonderful results. Anyway, I think we left off last week in telling the story of AA getting started, with Bill having visited Dr. Bob out in Akron, Ohio, and how this great social program was started by two people from Vermont, which is just the most wonderful irony in the world. And after staying there for a while, they called on AA number 3, Bill Dodson, who was a lawyer, and then they got a guy named Ernie Galbraith sober, and then Bill went back to New York, and Dr. Bob kept working, looking for drunks in Akron. And Bill went back and worked on drunks in the New York area. And when he got back, here he is by himself. He's got this idea of trying to get something that's really going to help alcoholics all over the place. He's got about 7 months sobriety himself, and he's broke. Doesn't even have a job. And he's trying to figure out how in the world to make this work. And a funny thing happened, because two guys came out of Towns Hospital, which is where Bill went through. One of them had been there 9 times before. This was his 10th time. And another one, this was his first time, and they both fed into the Oxford group, had a little bit of sobriety, and when they met Bill, they both immediately took to his ideas. They just said, oh my God, we want to be part of that team. So I think it was very important that Bill run into Fitz Mayo and Hank Parkhurst. And both of their stories are in the first edition of the Big Book. Hank is the unbeliever, and Fitz Mayo is the Southern gentleman. And Fitz's father was a minister in Virginia, and he was more of the intellectual type and liked to think about things, and made a nice addition in Bill getting perspective on things. Whereas Hank Parkhurst was a bull. A hard-charging salesman. He was he managed people. He was in charge. He used to be a football player. And he just was, let's go. In other words, you just didn't sit down and discuss the strategy. You just went full speed ahead, which was a nice combination to have at this stage of the game. Fitz eventually, I mean, this is, you know, we talk now about well, somebody only has 2 years. Do we want them to lead the meeting? Or it's, well, he only has 2 years, then maybe he shouldn't speak yet at an open meeting. So with a little under 2 years, Fitz went and started AA in Washington, D.C. And it became incredibly successful. They had all kinds of meetings there by 1940. And he remained a constant supporter of AA activity. He would go to Akron and come to New York whenever he was needed to review the big book, to do whatever was necessary. But Bill's real partner was Hank Parkhurst. This was the guy that got things going. And shortly after he got sober, now, you know, in the Oxford group, they really had this spiritual awakenings. They went in those rooms and, do you believe in God? I mean, they got on their knees and God bless America. And it was cranked up. And we got up and testified, and so he was really fired up about sobriety. And he had a convertible car that he drove Bill and Fitz around in. And they were driving down Park Avenue one night, and Bill looked over, and he was standing up while he was driving. And he shouted out, God Almighty, booze was never as good as this. And so he really was into his spiritual awakening and how wonderful it makes you feel. And he was just as fired up as Bill was about sharing this. We got to get this word out to the alcoholics that are still suffering. And he tied right in with Bill's idea that what we needed most of all was money. That was the secret to everything. I mean, how are you going to get a worldwide organization together without money? And Bill worked on Wall Street, so you can see his plan was for a chain of drunk tanks, because the hospitals were getting upset when you tried to get alcoholics sober there. They threw up all over the other patients, and it was hard for hospitals to have a policy of accepting people to dry out. And so he wanted a chain of drunk tanks, and then he wanted the drunks to quit their jobs and travel around the country starting AA in different cities, and that was going to take dough. So we'd have to pay for these guys like paid missionaries. And then eventually we're going to need a book so that we're all singing from the same page. But the book wasn't the big thing in the beginning. What was the big thing was raising money. And Hank was his buddy. And boy, they're going to go out and they're going to raise money. And they spent about a whole year trying to raise money, and they got nothing. They got nothing. They'd go to these foundations, they'd go to rich people in New York, and Bill's connections from Wall Street, and people would say, well, what are you talking about? A couple of drunks? I mean, I'd rather give to the Boy Scouts or something like that. I just don't see it. They didn't raise anything. And Bill had a brother-in-law who was a doctor, who was a very important player in Bill's sobriety, because he kept paying for him to go to town's hospital. Probably wouldn't have made it without his brother-in-law's money. And he was commiserating with him, he and Hank. And he allowed, as how he had met somebody from the Rockefeller office last year. And he thought he had his name, and would he like him to call this guy? And yeah. So he called him up, and it turned out to be Rockefeller's personal secretary, the guy who made all the decisions on what went in front of John Rockefeller to look at the Rockefeller Foundation, and his name was Willard Richardson. And he said, come on over. They didn't even have to wait. So Bill's on the elevator in the Rockefeller Center, or wherever the headquarters was, and he gets out on Rockefeller's floor. So he's going, the dough is near. We are close to the jackpot. And the two of them started telling him about this thing where they're using spiritual principles to help drunks get sober, and we got about 15 of us that are really doing well in Akron and here. And Richardson, who looked at a lot of worthy causes, thought this one was a real winner and Rockefeller would love it. So he said, could you guys come back and meet the trustees and the big advisors? Oh, yeah. So they had a big meeting in the conference room. And they described all this, and they said, oh, yeah, let's send a couple of these guys out to Akron. They can do a written report for Mr. Rockefeller. So they went out, and they taught Dr. Bob. They went to the hospital, and they saw the work that was being done. They typed up this report and gave it to Mr. Rockefeller, and they waited and waited. And then Willard Richardson was called in, and Rockefeller said, this looks like a very wonderful thing. I don't know when I've ever been moved by something like this. But I think money will spoil it. Now, I'll be willing to donate a few dollars so these guys don't get their homes foreclosed and this Mr. Wilson and Dr. Smith can have $30 a month so that they can hang in there. But I honestly think large amounts of money would be a big mistake. Which didn't set well with Hank and Bill. But it turns out it was God's plan that we don't get money in here, because it really would screw it all up, and there wasn't any coming. And so they formed an alcoholic foundation. Because Bill decided, in spite of what Rockefeller said, they got to raise money. And the way to raise it is to have a foundation, and they got some of the people from the Rockefeller Foundation to be on the board, and it was called the Alcoholic Foundation, and it was to raise money. So now they went out with the Alcoholic Foundation, and they're going here and going there, and they're going nowhere. Now, in order to raise money, Bill had written two chapters that ended up in our big book. And it was A Vision for You and Bill's Story. And he used these two chapters when he was hitting up people for dough. He would leave that with him. He had multi-lift copies. And he would go in there and go, well, we got this organization. Here, read this. Read about what's going to be happening. And even after they read them, they didn't make any, it didn't, nobody gave any money. But somebody that Bill knew said, why don't you take those two chapters down to Harper's Publishing and talk to the religious editor down there. See what he thinks. And so they took it down there, and the religious editor said, this is very good. We'd like to publish a book like this. Do you think you can finish this book? Bill said, of course, I have it done very soon. And they offered him $1,500 as an advance. And boy, did that sound good. This is, back in 1938, and that's a lot of money. And when you're broke, it's really a lot of money. But Hank Parkhurst talked Bill out of it. We don't want them having the profits off of this book. We want to keep this for ourselves. We can form our own publishing company, and then we'll make all the money. I mean, they were both. And Bill kind of went, yeah, that is a good idea. We'll make the money. And, of course, it's so hard to publish a book or to get anything like this started. But with those two power drivers, they're ready to go. So Hank goes in and gets some stock certificates and a blank letter of incorporation. They never did get it incorporated for a couple years. But he wrote out stock certificates in the Works Publishing Company, par value $25. You could make payments over 5 months of $5 a month. And they went to the AA meeting selling the stock certificates to the drunks. Well, they weren't AA meetings. They were the Oxford meetings plus the alcohol squad that met at Bill's house. And they also met in the restaurant after meeting. So there was the meeting after the meeting, even when it was the Oxford. And the drunk said, you want us to buy stock in a book that ain't written yet? I don't think so. So they knew they had to get something, and Hank and Bill went up to Pleasantville, where the Reader's Digest was headquartered, and they talked to one of the editors there, and they told them about this book and this organization, and the editor said, "My God, that's exactly what Reader's Digest loved. We love doing human interest stories, and yes, I think we'd be very interested in this." And Hank said, "And you'll mention the book?" And he said, "Yes, yeah, we'll mention the book. You call me when the book is finished, and we'll get ready to go." Well, now they went back to the Oxford drunks, and they said, "Boys, we've done some checking here. We checked with the printer, and they can print one of these books for 35 cents. And we're going to sell them for $3.50, 1,000% profit. We've gone up to Reader's Digest. They're going to run a story about this book as soon as it's finished, and they have 12 million readers. So here's your chance, boys. These books are going to go out in carload lots. You are going to get rich." Well, they sold a few here and a few there, and Charlie Towns from Towns Hospital dropped in a couple $1,000s. And slowly the book project is moving along. And it got quite a bit along, and so they had to hand out the chapters to write. That all the writing was now going on. And authorship of the chapters is debated. You can look at different history books as to who wrote what, but clearly Bill wrote a great deal of it. Hank Parkhurst wrote the chapter to the employer, which when you look at the beginning of that, he talks about being an executive in a large corporation with 6,600 employees, and that was his job with Standard Oil. And and also, Bill and Hank edited the stories of the 12 stories from the New York people, much to their resentment, because they didn't check with them about changing the stories. They just changed them, make them sound better in the book. And out in Akron, they had a newspaper man that edited the stories out there. So they ended up getting the stories together. They're getting all this, and they've got a pretty good draft, and they put it together. They had a heck of a falling out over the how it works. Bill hated to write that chapter. He said, "Oh my God, I don't want to do that," because there was enough controversy over everything else. But he finally was sitting there looking at the six tenants of the Oxford group, which is basically what they were using, and he started thinking that the drunks were sneaking through the loopholes in those 12 tenants. So he started with a legal pad and a pencil to close the loopholes, and so the drunks couldn't wiggle out. And when he got through, he felt very spiritually wonderful, because it ended up 12. And there were 12 apostles. There was 12 months in a year. You know, this looks very spiritual. I'm glad it ended up 12. So you can see it was just totally arbitrary, but he made a big deal out of it. And when he circulated it, then all hell started breaking loose. Because Hank and Jim Burwell of New York, Jim was a Reformed atheist, and they did not want a religious type program. They wanted a psychological program. So you talk about the psychological problems of the alcoholic, and then after they get here, you can slowly work in some spiritual stuff. But in their opinion, it would scare all the drunks off, so we can't have that. That's the New York crowd. Now, in Akron, they wanted to just have it be Jesus. Why beat around the bush? And so you got these two factors going, you know, it's going to be Jesus, no, it's going to be nothing. And out of that terrible conflict came God as I Understand Him. And that solved the problem because the New York guys could say, that really means psychological. And so they really got this thing going. They had the multi-lift. They sent it around to a few people to look at. They sent it to the Catholic Committee on Publications. And they thought it was pretty good, but they wanted one thing changed in Bill's story, where he said that he was catapulted into heaven. And they felt that the Catholic Church was the direction to get to heaven, and that they had promised that to all of its people. So would he mind changing that word? And so he did, and he changed it to utopia. So if you're ever reading that, you'll know that the Catholics got their little finger in the pie after all. And so they're all set now, so they go back to Reader's Digest, and they go in there and they go, Mr. Blackwell, we're ready to shoot. And he said, shoot what? He said, the book. We got the book ready. Oh, you're the guys that came up here about 6 months ago. Yeah, I remember you guys now. You know, I thought it was a great idea, but when I talked to the senior editors, they didn't like the idea at all, and I forgot to call you. So now they were really, they had all these loans and the stock certificates out, and they can't pay the printer. And so one of them, an Irishman named Ryan, had a friend who knew Gabriel Heater. Now, Gabriel Heater had a radio show that was kind of like today would be Larry King. You follow what I'm saying? Everybody listened. And during the show, we always had a human interest thing. And so they called him up, and by God, he would get Ryan on there, and Ryan would talk about his recovery and the book. And so this was all set, but Ryan had a tendency to slip. And the radio show wasn't for 10 days. And so Bill got four big guys and put Ryan in the New York Athletic Club under guard night and day. And he made it to the Gabriel Heater show, and it did go out, and it helped some of the orders to come in. But it was a very difficult thing and very close. I can't go into all the details, but it did finally make it, but with some loans from one guy from Baltimore and another one from Dr. Silkworth. And then something bad happened. Hank had been Bill's partner from the day they met. And Hank had an office. He was still in the oil business, even though he got fired from Standard Oil. And he had an office over in New Jersey. And he and Bill came up with this idea of forming a co-op so that the northern New Jersey gasoline dealers could buy at great quantity and save money. And it was called the Honor Dealers. And the funny thing was that the secretary that Hank had name was Ruth Houck. And when Bill came over working on this, it wasn't long before all Ruth saw were drunks coming in there to get sobered up. And there wasn't any oil business going on. And then when they got the idea for the book, guess who typed our big book? Ruth Houck. Typing it, Bill would dictate, and she would type, and then he'd come back with corrections, and she'd retype it. And they were broke, so they didn't have much money to pay her salary, but they would give her stock certificates in the Works Publishing Company, not yet incorporated. Here's another stock certificate, Ruth. Go ahead and keep typing. This is going to be worth a lot of money someday. So you can see, everything is just hanging in the balance. Hank was going through troubles with his wife, and it got worse and worse. In the middle of that, he took a liking to Ruth, And the two of them started dating a little bit. And then Hank's wife sued him for divorce, sued him for everything that he had, called him a lot of bad names, and he came in feeling terrible and told Ruth he really wanted to marry her. And Ruth said, "No, I can't do that. I want to keep working on this book project." And that really irked Hank that his buddy Bill was taking his girlfriend away from him to work on the project. And he did what any good alcoholic would do in a situation like that. He got drunk at Bill for this outrageous conduct, and it caused a lot of serious problems for Alcoholics Anonymous. He got drunk. He would come in the office and threaten people. They eventually wanted to move the office into New York where Bill was. And without checking with him, they did move it. The furniture was his, and now it was in New York. And Bill had decided that there was enough money to buy back all the shares in the Works Publishing Company, which would give the big book to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wouldn't be to any shareholders or anything like that, except for Hank's shares. And so Hank came in drunk and upset, saw the furniture, and accused Bill of stealing it. So Bill said, "Well, listen, why don't I give you $200 for that furniture and you hand over the stocks?" And Hank was desperate, so he handed them over. And then he went out to Cleveland to get a little sympathy from his brother-in-law, Clarence Snyder. Now, Clarence was Mr. AA in Cleveland, and I'm going to tell you some stories about Clarence at another time, probably next week. But he was really amazing. But he didn't like the idea of a centralized AA, and he didn't like Bill Wilson getting all the publicity. "Oh, Bill Wilson, Bill Wilson, Bill Wilson." You know, it's like, Jesus. Because Clarence had started the first intergroup. He had done the first pamphlets. He had written stuff on everything. And he was really an amazing 12-stepper and one of the great contributors to our program. But he also was sympathetic to Hank. And he listened to Hank's version, how he got cheated out of the money that was coming from the big book. And then Hank said, "Now Dr. Bob and Bill are going to get rich. And besides that, I know they're doing something with the Rockefellers. I think Rockefeller secretly gave them $64,000. You ever wonder why Dr. Bob wrote Gossip? That's to be... You have to watch that in his last talk. Gossip did a lot of damage right here. And so, as a matter of fact, Dr. Silkworth took a look at Hank Parker's and told Bill that he thought he was getting paranoid and that he might be dangerous. So it was that type of a situation. He caused so much trouble out there because Hank took his cause and went to all the Cleveland groups and said, "My friend tells me what's going on in New York, and they're making a lot of money, they've got to deal with..." I mean, they just repeated a lot of things that really weren't true. And then the word started coming into New York that the Cleveland groups were going to leave the big organization and go out on their own. So Dr. Bob and Bill went out to Cleveland to talk to the people. And they held a regular dinner with the speakers, and Bill and Dr. Bob spoke, and there appeared to be some sort of understanding. But as soon as that part was over, four or five of the Cleveland guys said, "Now we want to meet you two over here in this other room." And in that other room was a lawyer and a CPA, and they were armed to the teeth with evidence of this terrible wrongdoings that are going on. In other words, they were really ambushed. They had no idea this was coming. But Bill did bring with him all the financial records. And so at the end of the thing, they just said, all right, well, here, we'll turn them over to the CPA. This is the current financial status. Bill and Bob are both broke. They're getting $35 to $50 a month, and there's nothing coming in. The whole thing was not true. So the people that were there apologized and accepted that, but the buzz continued for years that those guys in New York, they were up to something, and we know. And so it took quite a while for that to settle down. So you can see when you start something in AA, especially back when AA was so new, it was frightening because that might mean the whole thing could collapse. And then we wouldn't stay sober and so on down. Anyway, Hank never really got sober again. He had a few years here and there, but never, and he died in 1954. And they never could resume their friendship and all of that. But having said all that, he was one of the main players in ensuring that our organization got started. His enthusiasm and the way he just didn't take no for an answer got us over a lot of hurdles that we should be grateful for. And Fitz, the Southern gentleman, actually brought AA to Maryland as well as Washington, D.C., and was one of the great characters that we had in the early history. The last one that I mentioned earlier was Ernie Galbraith. And Ernie's claim to fame, anybody here know Ernie's claim to fame? He eloped with Dr. Bob's daughter with about 3 months sobriety, which did not go over well with Dr. Bob. So this outrageous behavior on the part of newcomers started early, didn't it? Don't get in a relationship for the first one. Okay, Dr. Bob, come on, let's go. So anyway, that's where we'll leave it off in our little drama about the unfolding of the AA story. And there are so many stories that we could add in here, but I want to save time to get back on the spiritual path with these principles. And I think I mentioned, if I didn't, I'm going to mention it now, that sometimes it's helpful to jump all the way to the last step. It's like reading the last, the ending of a book, and then you go back and read the rest of it. And the reason that's interesting is because the last step tells us what the point of the other steps are. So if you know that ahead of time, then you can see, well, what is this all about? And the last step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. One result is all that's talked about. You get a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry the message to alcoholics. What message? How to have a spiritual awakening. It's very important to know that's the message that we're passing on. Not just how to stay sober, but how to transform yourself so that sobriety is fun and that the world looks different. And so that's the point of the whole thing. So as we go back to the beginning, we can see that we're taking a series of actions that is going to cause this to happen. And I don't know if I mentioned last time Dr. Young's quote about religion. Did I mention that? Oh, okay. The primary job of religion was to keep the people away from direct contact with God. And AA is just the opposite. The point here is to have your own personal experience. And so we talked about surrendering, and it has to be 100% or nothing else will happen. And then we talked about the debate process of slowly allowing ourselves to say maybe to the idea that there's a higher power, and to really get honest and tell ourselves we never did give spirituality a fair shake. We laughed at it, we gave it lip service, but we never really did give this thing a fair trial. And so we're in a situation where unless this works, we're probably going to die, so why not give it a shot? And so that's where we were able to come to believe in a power greater than ourselves, restoring us to sanity. And we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of this power, God as we understand him. And this is, came out of that big argument from Akron and New York. That sounds almost impossible. I see, I'm going to turn my life over to something that I don't even know if it exists. I am going to turn my life, that just sounds too mysterious. It sounds too far out. Made a decision to turn my life over. Well, let's take a look at our lives today prior to doing that. We're running our own lives. We're not turning it over to anything. We are the final arbiter of every single thing that we do. Nobody tells me what to do. I decide. I am the one who makes all the decisions about my life. And if you have the type of sponsor I have, he says, "Hey, how's it going?" And if you're honest, you go, "Not good." Now there's a beginning. There's a beginning. My sponsor said, if we could get you to stop doing it, we would remove the management of your life from an idiot. And so, if we can't believe in anything else, we could believe that if I stop running it, it's probably going to improve. Self-centeredness. That's, Bill just goes into that in the big book. Self-centeredness, the root of our problem. Self-centeredness, selfishness. We step on people's feet. We're in constant conflict with everybody around us. Selfishness, self-centeredness. They say it enough and finally go, okay, I'll go along with that. All right, I am self-centered. I've known it for a long time, but I've never admitted it. And all self-centered people make the following statement once they admit they're self-centered. I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to damn well do something about being self-centered. Oh, good. What are you actually going to do? Well, I'm going to focus on not being self-centered. I see you are going to sit there and focus on not being the center. Yes. Well, when you look at it, you go, that's impossible. I'm still the center of becoming unself-centered. It's just a joke to think that I can become unself-centered. So the only answer, possibly, is to find something else to be the center. And in the beginning, it's liable to be our sponsor. I'll make my sponsor the center of my life, and I'll let him or her make all the decisions for me, on my behalf, and gently under our breath until I get my act together, and then I'll take it back. But we don't say that out loud. So we're making a little concession in this direction. You can see that. And then we go, well, yeah, with respect to alcohol, it makes sense. This AA program, they know a lot more about alcohol. So I'm going to take this little alcohol chunk and turn that over. So there's a big step in the right direction. But with all other areas of my life, I think I'll still keep them. Because, and I always love this sentence, if I turn everything over, I will be the hole in the donut. I will be a non-entity. I will have nothing to do. Because right now my full-time job is running my life. And so this whole thing's just, my God, I'm going to turn this over. Well, a lot of times we come in here and we talk about being a slave to alcohol. That alcohol got a hold of us and all of a sudden it totally controlled our lives. And we really didn't have a say-so in how things were going. I wanted to not have a drink, but there was nothing I could do about it, and so I did, and then as soon as I drank, I didn't know what was going to happen. It was up to the alcohol. I might wake up in my own hometown, or I might be two states over. It was being directed by alcohol, and I desperately wanted my freedom back. We hear a lot about freedom in AA, and my choice back. Oh, my choice back and my freedom. And so when we get to AA and we get free from alcohol, now we got what we asked for. Freedom. Now I can do anything I want. Let's see. What should I do? What would be best for me? Well, maybe this plan. So I try that, and people are in my way. They're blocking me. I can't get there. Maybe this would be a better plan. Turns out that freedom is not all it's cracked up to be. It's a big struggle. I'm free to do anything. All my choices are here. I'm standing right here. I can go 360 different directions. But I can't figure out which one is best for me. So right now I'm standing still. And so this is what we get back. And when we first get it, we go, I love it. I'm not trapped in there. I'm not a slave to alcohol anymore. And Bill goes on and goes, I wonder how independent we really are. Are we independent of our character defects? Are we making the decision, or is greed making the decision? Are we making the decision, or is pride making the decision? Am I making this decision freely, or is lust influencing me slightly in the decision that I make? Am I not, in fact, being jerked around by all my character defects, even when I'm sober? Am I in a constant state of frustration and anger, restless, irritable, discontent, sober? I'm being yanked around by all these forces. My life is a mess with all this freedom. What am I going to do about that? Now, the funny thing is, the highest pay grade in Alcoholics Anonymous is servant. And a servant is someone who willingly allows a power greater than ourselves to tell us what to do. A slave doesn't have any choice. They're forced to do the work whether they want to or not. And ironically, the jobs that a slave and a servant do sometimes look very much similar. Both of them are sweeping the floor. Both of them are picking up boxes in a supermarket, which a lot of us drunks, when we're new, that's what we're doing. Only the servant is happily doing it because it was their choice. It was their choice to give up their choice. So as Bill explores this in both the big book and the 12 and 12, he discusses how independent we really are. Maybe we just think we're independent. And we encounter the second spiritual paradox of our program, the first being that we win by giving up, that victory is achieved through surrender. And now we're going to find out that true independence is achieved by becoming dependent on a loving higher power. That the best possible life for me would be one that was guided by my own Creator, my own loving Creator, who knows way beyond me what's best for me. And so this step is the beginning of this process. And nothing gets turned over in the third step. I remember reading it and then going, okay, I got to get my life turned over. Over, turnover. Okay, over, over. When you're new, you do really weird things. And so I always try to do these things in front of a mirror because I figured the facial expression was crucial in whether your life was turned over or not. So I'd get in front of a mirror. Okay, God, you got it. No. Okay, God, you got it. No. So no matter what I did, I didn't feel like anything happened. I mean, I was turning and turning and turning. Okay, God, you got it. Okay, God, take it. Okay, God, you got it. Got it. Got it. Gone. Gone. Done. And there I am, still in charge. It didn't say that we got it turned over. It says we made a decision to turn our life over, which is like making a decision to get a college degree. There's still some work to do before we get the degree. And so something that is completely turned over is an awakening. So what that leaves us with is the rest of the steps, which is between us and our own Creator. And so as we leave this step and begin this journey, the whole journey will depend on how earnestly we are trying to turn our life over. And Bill makes an interesting comment in the 12 and 12 where he talks about willpower. It's the first time I think it shows up in the literature. And of course, if you have a sponsor like I do, he said, there's no way you can stay sober on willpower. Don't even think about it. I mean, drunks just can't resist alcohol, so don't even think that this can be done by willpower. And then it turns out the only way to do it is through willpower. So that sounds like you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. Well, you can't directly achieve sobriety through your own willpower. But it takes willpower to go to meetings. It takes willpower to buy the big book and read it. It takes willpower to do the steps. I have to make this choice. And so Bill puts in the 12 and 12 that this is the proper use of the will to bring it in harmony with that of our higher power. He also talks about free will, which I've always been interested in. I've often wondered if I ever have free will. You know what I mean? Because it seemed like my character defects were always jerking me around. But my influence of my parents, the influence of the church, the influence of what I had read, the influence of the universe. Well, how do I know whether I'm free to make any kind of a choice? So that debate could go on forever, the determinism and free will. But I'll make you a bet on this one. There's one area where we have free will, absolute, complete free will. We can either choose God or not choose God. That is absolutely up to us. And what is suggested here is you've gotten this far by not choosing God. And that was all of us. We may have heard about it before, but we never chose it. We just abandoned it. I stopped going to church on Sunday because I was too drunk on Saturday night. And so what is left here is, why don't you try choosing, quote, God, higher power, and then see what kind of results you get. And so my point to anybody new is, your job is to no longer manage your life. You follow the guidance from your sponsor and your group and from the literature and our spiritual program. You have a huge job, though. Your job is to keep very careful track of the results and report back whether things are going worse or better. Just jot them down. Wow, another month went by. I seem to be better. We don't even want to... First, we don't want to admit it, because then we'd be wrong. Because we already told everybody this wasn't going to work. That kind of stuff doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for me. And when it does work, I remember I didn't want to tell my sponsor. I was secretly getting happy from praying. Because I knew all my buddies would jump out and go, ha, 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 ha. But it was. There is nothing like personal results to convince us of the reality of this program and our own Creator. And so if you're at this step, turn everything over except judging the results. And I think you're going to find that you're off for a heck of a good ride. I tell new people that I sponsor, there's only one question you should ever ask. What should I do next? That's it. Okay, I'm up here now. What should I do next? Okay, I want to run, 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 run. Now, if you do that, whatever it is, the reason you're going to be happy is, in order to do it, you have to get willing. You have to become willing. Oh, you want me to go early and make the coffee? I don't want to do that. Okay. Second you say, okay. You know that process I'm talking about? Okay. You feel like $1 million. You feel like $1 million. No more resistance, no more barrier to all this stuff. Okay, I'm a player. Okay, count me in. Never thought I'd join a dirtbag organization like this, but okay, I'm a member. All right. That is when happiness begins. Okay, I'll do it. Instead of, no, never. Oh, it's so lonely out in No Neverland. Oh, it's terrible out there. There's many of us spent a lot of time out there. Finally, we had to swallow our pride, come back. Okay, what do you want me to do? And that was the beginning of quite a nice life. So whenever you can, just go, okay. All right, we're at the end of the time, and we'll wrap it up with the Lord's Prayer for anybody who cares to join in. And thanks for your attention.